Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show Friday Drive Time with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We hear from Bristol Iranian, or Iranian Bristolian, Mehrnaz Shahabi, to get her thoughts on the Syrian civil war, chemical weapons and the new regime in Iran. Plus a look back at the old killings of the Jack the Ripper cases back in the Victorian times, as well as Martin Summers taking us on a tour of the weekly hotspots of the world. We start with what seems like quite good news this week, Martin, from the Middle East, and at least some sort of talk now about peace, possibly even a ceasefire in Syria.
Well, one would hope that there is a momentum now for some kind of political negotiation, but of course people are dying every day, not just in Syria. There's been clashes in Yemen, people are dying in Iraq, there's still fighting going on in Libya. I'm afraid the dangers are still there, even if we've been avoided a major conflagration over the last few weeks.
Just give us an idea of the situation in Iraq, because I thought that was supposed to be all over with, but we seem to keep hearing reports about multiple bombings, possibly suicide bombings. No one really knows sometimes who's planted these bombs, and this just seems to go on week after week after week until it doesn't actually make the news anymore.
Well, the Iraqi and Syrian situations are interlinked. So many of the Sunni jihadists who are basically blowing up Shia mosques inside Iraq, potentially with Saudi support, are the same people who are trying to overthrow Assad in Syria. The elected government of Iraq, the Maliki government, Maliki is a Shia. They are aligned towards Iran and aligned towards Bashar al-Assad. So we went to war to bring a democracy to Iraq, and that democracy is saying don't get involved in Syria because we think that we're actually supportive of the Assad regime. And the foreign minister from the Syrian regime today or yesterday said, let's have a ceasefire and then we can have a democratic election, but we're not just going to give way. He's actually from the opposition, the peaceful opposition, who's gone into the government with Assad. So it's not nearly, and of course what you've actually got is more than two factions fighting in Syria. The Kurds have been driven out of northern Syria by the al-Nusra Front, and of course the KDP inside Iraq, the Kurdish Democratic Party, may come in over the border to defend the Kurds inside Syria. So it's far more complicated than we're being presented, and I think the British people are quite sensible in a way. They realise that it's complicated, and because they realise that it's complicated, they realise there's no simple solution. And they don't know all the detail, they don't need to know all the detail to realise that it's more complicated than they're being told. It's not black and white.
Now, going back to Sunday, we had another one of these multiple bomb attacks in Iraq, more than 58 dead, 120 wounded as concurrent car bombs go off across Iraq, was reported. Most casualties were recorded in the city of Hilla, near the capital Baghdad, where twin car bombs set off near a busy market killed 15 people and wounded 29 more. I mean, what is going on here, Martin? This is supposed to be a country which we were supposed to get rid of some evil dictator. Now there's just a massacre going on almost every week, another one of these multiple
attacks. Well, I wouldn't sit here and say I know what's going on in Iraq. I don't. I try and keep up with what's going on, as people do.
I can tell you what one former Iraqi official says, and that is that Saudi Arabia is behind the armed terrorism in Iraq. This is a press TV last weekend. The United Nations figures also say that over 4,000 people have died in terrorist attacks in Iraq so far in 2013, with Baghdad province hit the worst. 4,000 people have been killed and 10,000 people injured just in 2013 so far. Iraq's former national security advisor says Saudi Arabia is one of the major supporters of armed terrorism plaguing the violence-stricken country. Mofawak al-Rubai said that all leaders of terrorist groups operating inside Iraq have come to the country from foreign states such as Saudi Arabia and Yemen, noting that Baghdad has managed to identify them. He further noted that over 1,000 Iraqi tribal sheikhs have recently rejected an invitation by Saudi King Abdullah bin Abdulaziz to attend a meeting in Riyadh, describing it as interference in Iraq's domestic Domestic Affairs. Recently, cables were released about a secret memo by Christopher Hill, former US ambassador to Iraq, sent to the US Department of State in September 2009, in which it was mentioned that Saudi Arabia constitutes the biggest challenge and the problem is more complex in relation to the Iraqi politicians who are trying to form a stable and independent government. Hill also said intelligence sources reported that Saudi Arabia is based in the effort to destabilise the government of Iraq and Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki.
Well, that's right, and the Maliki regime has also got a fairly ropey human rights record, so it's not as if it was black and white even there. But I think, let's be clear, the 19 hijackers on 9/11 supposedly, I don't accept this for a minute, but supposedly all came from Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is supporting the people who are blowing up mosques in Iraq. Saudi Arabia may have supplied the sarin, which was used in Damascus. That's what, or it may have come from Libya via MI6. Those are the kind of stories that are being pushed around out there in the real world. Now, at what point do we attack Saudi Arabia as the fount of all international terrorism? Oh, we wouldn't do that, of course, because MI6 have been working with Saudi Arabia since the 1980s. And, of course, the Saudi army is all trained at Sandhurst, and we supply them with loads of weapons from Filton, but they are the terrorists. Oh, never mind, never mind, never mind. It's all a lot more complicated than people being told, and also a lot simpler. Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, was on French TV last week. He made a very interesting observation. Well, he said,
last month, or a couple of months ago.
Actually. Yes, but it's still fairly clear what he said. He said, I was approached before the Arab Spring by British officials at an international meeting, and they said, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to be involved? Now, that is evidence that the whole armed uprising in Syria was begun by the British intelligence services, by MI6. We've had 100,000 dead so far, and if the chemical weapons attack turns out to have been carried out by the rebels with sarin supply, because the al-Nusra Front have been arrested inside Turkey by the Turkish police in possession of 2 kilograms of sarin, which probably came from Libya via MI6, then maybe it's about time we put some people in MI6, sent them to The Hague for carrying out chemical weapons attacks which kill 1,300 civilians, because it may not be the Damascus regime at all, it may be our own people.
But what motivation would it be for the Saudis to interfere in politics, to be blowing up bombs in Iraq?
Because the Saudi regime has got no legitimacy at all. They never have any elections in Saudi Arabia whatsoever. They've got 30,000 political prisoners. And if we're going to start redrawing the boundaries of the Middle East, for example, saying the Kurds can have their own state, which may be one of the things that will come out of the Syrian conflict, then at that stage we could say we're going to break up Saudi Arabia, because the eastern part of Saudi Arabia, the eastern part is where all the oil is actually predominantly Shia, and they could actually form a federation with Bahrain and have all the oil, and the Saudi royal family, who've got no legitimacy whatsoever, less legitimacy than Gaddafi, what should be done with them is like what we did with Gaddafi. The French special forces who went into Libya put a bayonet on his backside and shot him through the head on YouTube. Shouldn't that, I mean, isn't that British policy? Revolution? Revolution in Syria? Revolution in Yemen? Revolution in Saudi Arabia? Maybe revolution in Palestine as well. If the Israelis don't get back behind the green line, it's time to fight. This is what David Cameron seems to be saying. It's time to fight. It's time to draw a line in the sand. It's time for all of these regimes to go. Assad must go next week. The Saudi regime must go tomorrow. All got to go tomorrow, no matter how much blood is spilled. We're the British and we're prepared to fight to the end, of course.
Is it simply that that there are arms deals being done with people in Saudi Arabia, and that's why they're friendly regimes and they're not being done with the sort of enemy regimes like Iran and Syria?
Well, exactly. What's going on here is 19th century geopolitics with 21st century weapons. But if we're going to talk about illegitimate regimes, it's that NATO's own internal assessment, which was leaked, said that Assad had the support of around 70% of Syrians. I don't suppose the royal family in Saudi Arabia have got support of 70% of the people, but who would know, because they never have any elections anyway.
Well, I wonder
anyway.
If the royal family in Britain have got the support of 70% of the population. Anyway, Martin, one particular incident this week, Turkish warplanes shot down a Syrian helicopter, which apparently had crossed over into Syrian airspace. No one's quite sure whether it did or not, but certainly one thing's for sure is this helicopter, is a Russian-made helicopter, actually came down within Syria itself. So the Turkish may be being a bit cheeky. There was also an incident, wasn't there, months ago with a Phantom jet being shot down. So it's getting a bit tense on that Syrian Turkish border.
Nobody doubts for a moment that the foreign jihadis from Libya and elsewhere are infiltrating into Syria over the Turkish border with the support of the NATO army, the Turkish NATO army, British and US intelligence services and special forces. Nobody disputes that. Of course, the Turkish police, as I mentioned a minute ago, have arrested Al-Nusra Front activists inside Turkey, where they were investigating a bomb attack inside Turkey in one of the villages close to the border, and they found they had 2 kilograms of sarin. And they're going to be charged with, you know, attempting to use chemical weapons and all the rest of it, which is quite interesting, as the police that seem to be acting independently there, as genuine police forces should do. Now, of course, the other thing is that the Alawite minority in Syria, which is the same kind of religious belief as Bashar al-Assad has, they actually are concentrated on the Turkish border. So many of the people who live close to the border with Syria, on the other side of the border from Turkey, are actually sympathetic to Assad, whereas the Sunni-led Justice and Development Party, which is ruling from Ankara, are very keen on removing Assad. But of course, we've also seen in Egypt, we haven't mentioned that, the army is still killing people. They raided some place this week and killed a lot of people. When is the RAF going to stop bombing there?
This is a particularly horrific situation in Egypt right now, where you've got supporters of the ruling, what it was up until a couple of months ago, ruling Muslim Brotherhood, are now deemed criminals. At least the organisers of the Muslim Brotherhood are being rounded up, some shot, and put into jail.
Well, I mean, what we said in Libya was it's time to take up arms, isn't it? That's what we said in Syria. It's time to take up arms. It's time for the Muslim Brotherhood to start fighting back. If they start fighting back, eventually the RAF will turn up and knock out the Egyptian tanks, and eventually we'll get democracy out of the fighting.
What's the agenda here? What's going on in Egypt?
Well, what's going on in Egypt, again, I don't want to sit I've just read a very interesting book about the history of the politics of Egypt. It's called Spies, Statesmen and... I can't remember the other bit of the title. But anyway, the fact is what you've got is the army and the security apparatus in Egypt are not necessarily on the same side. The Muslim Brotherhood and the kind of secular opposition are not necessarily on the same side. And like a lot of other things, it's actually quite complicated. It isn't black and white, and nor is Syria.
But I mean, there was an election there. Morsi was elected.
Yes,
he was only 51% of the vote. But
yes,
he was elected as the president. He is now in jail.
Yes.
That doesn't sound like democracy to me.
No, well, it's exactly what happened in Algeria in the 90s when the FIS, the Islamic Salvation Front, looked as if they were going to win the second round of the election. The Algerian army closed down the election. It led to a civil war in which up to 1 million people died. Now, if we're going to push armed uprisings in Syria and in Libya, what I say to the British government is this: armed uprisings can be pushed anywhere against your puppets as well as the puppets of other people. And once you've got armed uprising, I mean, the lesson is absolutely clear, isn't it? If you want to free yourselves, peaceful methods won't do it. It's the Libyan way all the way. In Syria, in Palestine, in Saudi Arabia, in all of these puppet states of the West, they've all got to be swept away by an armed uprising. We said the armed uprising in Syria is good. The RAF will come and back it up. The same in Syria. Assad must go, otherwise there's going to be rivers of blood and the RAF are going to come in and bomb him. Right, okay. If we're going to have that sort of policy, then it's armed uprising everywhere.
Okay, so whose hands does this policy play into? Because it's certainly not good for the people who live in the Middle East.
No, it's not. But we've been going around pouring meths on this bonfire for several years now, haven't we? And of course, people in Britain are not like the Americans. We're not mindlessly belligerent, but people want to be belligerent and then they want to go and have a nice cup of tea in Britain, and it angers me and it makes me fed up with the way the British look at the world.
So what's
the Americans, on the other hand, like the idea of going in and kicking people around, although interestingly enough, when Obama talked about going to the Congress to back up an attack on Syria, he found that he wasn't getting support. Maybe what's happened in Britain and America is people are finally wising up to the evil policies of their own governments.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Now let's calm down a little bit and have a chat with Mayor Shahabi.
Hi, Mayor, welcome to Drive Time.
Hi.
First of all, give us an idea of how you have arrived here in Bristol and what's your origins.
Well, I'm originally from Iran. I came to Britain when I was 21, following the Iranian Revolution, and I married, had children, and stayed on.
So what was the situation over there? Were you unhappy with the revolution? Did you come over here because you...
No, I wasn't there, unfortunately, during the revolution. I left just before the revolution. I can't say that I was unhappy. I supported the revolution. I continue to support the revolution. Of course, not everything has gone right. There has been, in fact, throughout, since 1979, there has been pressure, there has been an imposed war, there has been interference, and like Russian revolution, they haven't allowed the revolution to blossom. So there are a lot of things which myself or other people could have cause for grievance, but fundamentally I continue to defend the revolution as signifying Iran's independence from the West, becoming an independent state.
What do you make of the new regime? Because we've just had elections, a new prime minister.
The new government of President Rouhani, it is very interesting because there was it was elected by 51% of the votes.
Oh, crikey, like Egypt.
And a lot of people, there was a lot of pressure for the boycott of the elections following the debacle of the 2009 elections and the accusations of rigging. However, when it came to the elections, a lot of people came out, also a lot of people, the expatriate community, and voted. And the government seems to have the mandate not just from the people, but also from the supreme leader to act. Its platform is improving Iranian economy, and also changes in foreign policy in terms of wanting to negotiate and have a sort of softer approach. Yes, I do support it.
Well, we've also seen this week, haven't we? Quite nice to see some release of some political prisoners. I wonder, is that enough?
Well, that was one of the things that Rouhani had been asked to do before the elections, that people were wanting him to release political prisoners and some civil freedoms, and it seems to be happening. Some laxing of the restrictions on the internet, and also release of some important political prisoners, 11 this week, 8 women and 3 men, one of them Nasrin Sotoudarad, who was a prominent lawyer and human rights activist. So that is cause for feeling good about it.
Yes, one of the things we do quite regularly on this show is we have little clips from Press TV. Now it's banned here in Britain, at least it's banned on the Freeview and on some of the satellites. What are your thoughts about Press TV? Because I mean, we've just had a story there, for example, one of the former senior security people in Iraq talking about the Saudi Arabians possibly being behind the terrorism, at least much of it, in Iraq. That's a story which I've only actually managed to find on Press TV. Nobody else seems to have him quoted. So what are your thoughts as an Iranian on how the English language service of Iran is actually operating?
Well, it's interesting in relation to Press TV, as far as the domestic news in Iran is concerned, I don't think it's that hot. But as far as the foreign news is concerned, it is actually a very good source of news. It's got news that you often don't find in the mainstream media, and you can have quick access to what has just come out in relation to what is happening in the Middle East, in relation to Palestine. So I think it's good.
So how do you actually manage to watch it yourself? Because I mean, I tend to only manage to see it on YouTube.
I also watch it on the internet.
I know this YouTube. Is annoying that you can't actually yes. pick it up on the satellite.
Yeah.
Martin, this is saying something, isn't it, about the way that discussions and debate internationally is managed now, when a country has the ability to really just simply close down, apart from just online, a particular channel from appearing on our TV screens. I mean, as is saying there, that she actually thinks that their coverage is quite good. Why aren't we allowed to see it here in Britain, and how does this impact on how we see the world around us?
Well, I think what's happened is all over the world people have realised that information is power, and as Manaz rightly says, you're probably not going to find out too much about Iran from watching Press TV, but it covers what else is going on in the world far better. And just like you're not going to find much out about what goes on in Britain from the BBC, or what goes on in Russia from Russia Today. But I think the fact that we've now got these competing English language international stations really has sharpened up the debate around the world. So, for example, this chemical weapons assault in Damascus, there are all sorts of competing narratives about it out there. In the past, they would have just told us a fib and we would have believed them. They can't do that anymore.
Well, interestingly, what came out in the WikiLeaks documents was that there was a pressure from the United States to close down the on Britain, to actually not allow Press TV to operate. And then in time it did happen, they closed it down.
I noticed also that the Anti-Defamation League got the YouTube channel of Press TV also closed down, but then they popped up, they just started a brand new one and started again. That was closed down and they finally got one which seems to be operating more regularly.
It seems to be very popular.
It is. And in a way I think this can be counterproductive trying to do this, because the internet being as it is, censorship is detected as damage to the network, and the network actually routes round it. So long as Press TV are prepared to use the internet in imaginative ways, hopefully they'll continue to be able to find some way of letting us know what Iranians think about what's going on in the world. Anyway, we mentioned briefly the chemical weapons there, and we're also talking about the way that this is discussed and debated. We've got one of those debates and discussions here, and that is that point of view of the US Secretary of State John Kerry. So let's have a listen to what he's had to say about the chemical weapons discussion and the possible attack on Syria, which was being contemplated by him, being pushed by him a month or so ago.
Well, for the last several days, President Obama and his entire national security team have been reviewing the situation in Syria. And today I want to provide an update on our efforts as we consider our response to the use of chemical weapons. What we saw in Syria last week should shock the conscience of the world. It defies any code of morality. Let me be clear. The indiscriminate slaughter of civilians, the killing of women and children and innocent bystanders by chemical weapons is a moral obscenity. By any standard, it is inexcusable, and despite the excuses and equivocations that some have manufactured, it is undeniable. The meaning of this attack goes beyond the conflict in Syria itself, and that conflict has already brought so much terrible suffering. This is about the large-scale, indiscriminate use of weapons that the civilized world long ago decided must never be used at all, a conviction shared even by countries that agree on little else. There is a clear reason that the world has banned entirely the use of chemical weapons. There is a reason the international community has set a clear standard, and why many countries have taken major steps to eradicate these weapons. There is a reason why President Obama has made it such a priority to stop the proliferation of these weapons and lock them down where they do exist. There is a reason why President Obama has made clear to the Assad regime that this international norm cannot be violated without consequences. And there is a reason why, no matter what you believe about Syria, all peoples and all nations who believe in the cause of our common humanity must stand up to assure that there is accountability for the use of chemical weapons so that it never happens again. Last night, after speaking with foreign ministers from around the world about the gravity of this situation, I went back and I watched the videos that anybody can watch in the social media, and I watched them one more gut-wrenching time. It is really hard to express in words the human suffering that they lay out before us. As a father, I can't get the image out of my head of a man who held up his dead child, wailing while chaos swirled around him. The images of entire families dead in their beds without a drop of blood or even a visible wound. Bodies contorting in spasms. Human suffering that we can never ignore or forget. Anyone who could claim that an attack of this staggering scale could be contrived or fabricated needs to check their conscience and their own moral compass.
That was US Secretary of State John Kerry there, and I'll start with you, Martin. I mean, he's saying anybody that's questioning whether or not some of the footage here that we've seen on our television screens could be fabricated needs to search their conscience.
Well, some of it was uploaded the day before the attack was supposed to have taken place, so it's bound to raise questions, isn't it, about what we're seeing here. Sister Mariam Agnes, I think she is
Mother Superior.
Mother Superior in Damascus was saying that they're getting evidence that some of the children in the videos are actually the children of Alawite families kidnapped from Latakia 2 weeks previously, then murdered to order by the Al-Nusra Front, and then put on the videos, and they've been caught doing this several times, killing regime loyalists, videoing the pictures, and then saying, gosh, the horrible government has killed these people. And you know who trained them in that kind of psychological warfare technique? MI6 and the CIA, the Turkish MIT, and the Saudi Mukhabarat, because they're not very nice people either. And of course, all this huffing and puffing about, nobody disputes that there was a chemical weapon attack. Not the Assad regime, not the Russians. They're just saying, in actual fact, it looks like the rebels, and the rebels have been caught with 2 kilograms of sarin inside Turkey. There's no dispute about that. And they're also, Carla Del Ponte, the UN investigator, said it was quite clear that the rebels had used sarin in a previous attack. So the rebels have been caught twice with their hands on sarin, but we've got to admit that it's got to be the Assad regime. Why would the Assad regime, in any case, attack a civilian target in Damascus, just as they got UN weapons inspectors arriving in the country at their invitation? Makes no sense. And of course, ultimately, if we do find out that MI6, the Saudi Mukhabarat, the Turkish MIT, were responsible for this chemical weapons attack, what do you think we should do, John Kerry? What do you think we should do with the CIA man who gave the order for that? What do you think we should do with him, John?
I would love to get John to answer your questions. Unfortunately, he's not here. But no. What are your thoughts, Mianaz, on this chemical attack? Pretty horrific pictures, weren't they?
It was horrific. What is... what came to my mind was actually in relation to what Martin was saying, the videos, was that John Kerry actually showed a picture of children, rows and rows of children in a morgue, and showed that to evoke feelings about what happened in Syria. In fact, that was a picture which was from 2003, US liberation of Iraq. And it had been used by the BBC in 2011, again ascribing it to what is happening in Syria. BBC got caught red-handed, and in fact Daily Telegraph wrote an article in relation to that with the picture, and the BBC had to apologize. And now John Kerry was presenting the same picture in relation to Syria. So that is as far as the outright lies. I am appalled and extremely upset by the outrageous hypocrisy of it. In the same week that John Kerry was talking about what the human community cannot accept, and it's outrageous. In fact, the declassified CIA documents showed that, of course we all knew that, but now their own documents have showed that the United States actively helped Saddam Hussein in chemical bombing of Iranian troops. There has been, and actually hid the evidence, there had been bombing of Iranian troops throughout Iran-Iraq war with chemical bombing between the beginning of the war, 1981 to 1988. And it had been, Iran had taken it to the Security Council but could not prove it, and United States, now there are evidence coming out, their own documents, that United States did its best to hide the evidence and knew that Iran couldn't prove it. Now in 1987, Iran had amassed lots of troops near Basra and was advancing. United States knew that. It took it to Reagan, and Reagan said, we cannot accept an Iranian victory. They knew that Saddam had chemical weapons. They informed Saddam. They informed him of whereabouts of the Iranian forces, and Saddam launched its horrific chemical attacks on Iranian soldiers that killed and injured tens of thousands, even say hundreds, 100,000 civilian and troops. And now they are talking, and their own use of, in Fallujah in 2004, phosphorus bombing that burns to the bone, isn't that chemical weapon? In Israel, in 2008, use of phosphorus bombs, white phosphorus on civilians, that killed so many civilians, children, old people. and it can't be extinguished. They gave the excuse that phosphorus bombing is not chemical weapons, but and it's not illegal. In fact, the use of it in areas which are inhabited and whether troops or civilians can be exposed to it is illegal. It is a war crime.
There's also, of course, the fact of the use of depleted uranium, which is really, really pretty appalling. And in fact, in some ways, more appalling than these things, which then might disperse, because this these causes birth defects into the infinite future, really,
through
generations. But I put it to you, Menes, that two wrongs don't make a right. Something needs to be done about this use of chemical weapons, as the UN have now said it was in Syria.
Of course, yes. And what is interesting is that Bashar al-Assad has said, and it was repeated by Russian foreign minister, that the reason that Assad had amassed chemical weapons was its fear of Israel having chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. That's actually the main instigator of chemical weapons in Syria, and Syria has agreed to get rid of its chemical weapons.
Yes, so Martin, what's going to happen there? Because I would be very surprised if Assad gave up his chemical weapons knowing that the Israelis have nuclear weapons next door.
I think he will give them up, but the problem is what they'll probably say is it's not giving them up quickly enough and they'll huff and puff. But I think increasingly, I think what the Russians know, they're holding the ace here, because it looks increasingly like this terrible attack inside Damascus was actually carried out by the rebels, probably with assistance from Western security forces, certainly the Turks, probably the Saudis, and probably the stuff came from Libya. That's what the Russian intelligence are now saying, because of course Libya had lots and lots of chemical weapons, but they were all captured by the rebels, who were trained by RSAS, and of course the SAS have been inside Syria, we know that. So all this huffing and puffing by Western politicians about chemical weapons will come back to haunt them if the Russians can show, and I think the Russians probably can show, there was actually your rebels and your intelligence services that did this. So perhaps you'd like to just shut up about chemical weapons. I presume that'll be the Russian strategy. Just shut up about chemical weapons, we'll say no more about it. But if you're going to push it, we will bring out the evidence, and then we'll see what you do. I mean, Agent Orange was dropped all over Vietnam, and it killed lots and lots of people. They're still getting birth defects decades later.
Well, of course, it's also caused massive defoliation.
Yes, and John Kerry was a soldier in the Vietnam War. Let's send him to prison.
Menes, what are your thoughts then about the way this is affecting things in Iran and Syria together? Because it seems that many people are saying, I mean, I would suggest this is probably true, that the Americans militarily see Syria as a stepping stone to Iran.
Well, I think it is really about, they say, the gate to Tehran is through Damascus. It is really about getting to Tehran. It's about weakening Tehran. It's interesting that Putin, when he'd gone to Israel discussing with Netanyahu had told him that, and he had the go-ahead from the United States, that they would accept Russia to have Syria as its sphere of influence so long as when Bashar Assad is brought down, he is replaced by someone who is not amenable to Iran. I mean, that says it all. It is really about bringing down a regime that is amenable to Iran getting to Iran, weakening Iran, and regime change in Syria and then in Iran.
Martin, what are your thoughts about whether that will be successful or not? Because it may be that by removing chemical weapons, Assad is buying himself time and not a lot more, that the real conflict going on there is between Syria and Israel.
And the West. I think what it seems to be happening is that the agreement on chemical weapons is being used by the Syrian regime as a means of getting a peace conference going, because they know in actual fact that the rebels can't organize themselves for a serious discussion, so that they're putting the ball into their court. Come on, talk to us. And the guy who was speaking yesterday was an oppositionist to Assad, who is now part of the regime. Mm. And things are more complicated than just as is happening in Iran. People who are oppositionists to the regime are now coming out of prison and could become part of a new government in Iran. Why not? And I think another thing that people in Britain need to realise is this was reported in the Daily Telegraph, that Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia went to talk to Putin a few weeks ago in Moscow, and he said, look, if you back down over Bashar al-Assad, or if you don't back down over Bashar al-Assad, we will tell our Chechen terrorists to attack your Winter Olympics in Sochi before Christmas. Now, there's going to be British teams competing at that Winter Olympics. Are we happy for the Saudi head of intelligence to go and threaten the Russians that his Chechen fighters, and there are Chechen fighters inside Syria as well, are going to attack the Winter Olympics unless they back down? I would call that terrorism by any definition. And of course, the Saudis are all... their soldiers are all trained at Sandhurst and their weaponry all comes from Bristol.
Martin, in the Wall Street Journal today, we're just hearing rebel-on-rebel violence is seizing Syria across northern and eastern parts of the country. Units of the jihadist group known as ISIS, or Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, are seizing territory on the battlefield and behind the front lines from the Western-backed Free Syrian Army rebels. An al-Qaeda spin-off operating near Aleppo, Syria's largest city, began a new battle campaign, dubbing it Expunging Filth. The target is not their avowed enemy, the Syrian government. Instead, it's their nominal ally, the US-backed Free Syrian Army.
Well, they're also fighting with the Kurds in northern Syria. And, of course, the KDP in Iraq. I mean, the PKK in Turkey are in negotiations with the Turkish government about some kind of settlement of that war, which has killed 30, 40,000 people over the last few years, although most people have never heard of it, because we're told it's what Brian Eno, the pop star, calls propaganda. The things we're supposed to care about, what's happening in Syria, not what's happening in Turkey, not what's happening in Iraq, not what's happening in Saudi Arabia, it's Syria, Syria, Syria. But of course, in actual fact, in the real world, in the Middle East, once you start, what could really happen here is we could start redrawing the boundaries. Mm-hmm. And if we agree to start redrawing the boundaries, then a failed state like Saudi Arabia is ripe for partition. And of course, the whole oil industry in Saudi Arabia is conveniently concentrated on the East Coast, right next to Bahrain. They've got a Shia majority there. They could have their own state and their own oil and put the whole Saudi royal family up against the wall like we did with Gaddafi.
Menaz, what are your thoughts about the future for your country or your place where you were born anyway?
Yes, well, currently I feel hopeful about the future. I think that there is every possibility, as far as the Iranian government is concerned at least, that the nuclear issue could be resolved. Iran has actually said that it's backed by the Supreme Leader.
Well, he said that just this week, didn't it?
Well, there has never been any intention for nuclear weapons, but they have reiterated that. But also the Supreme Leader has given his blessing to the President to reach a resolution of the nuclear issue and be flexible. So I think that as far as Iran is concerned, there is every possibility of resolving the issue. The ball is really in their court. But you see, the problem has never been Iran's nuclear program. It is really about regime change in Iran. And where I get my hope is not really what is happening in the United States government. I get my hope from the movements which are taking place globally, from people's consciousness. Like, for example, British Parliament being forced to not to support the United States for the first time after so many years, not to support United States in war, not to act as a puppet. That is really due to a movement in Britain taking place, a consciousness about against imperial wars. And I think what happened in relation to backing down from the war in the United States was that, like a pack of cards, this was actually transferred to the people in the United States. They saw that they have lost their closest allies. Then people in the United States put pressure on their congressmen, and Obama knew that they were not going to win. AIPAC was behind it, they were killing themselves. They were putting the most amount of pressure for the war resolution to go through. But of course, they didn't succeed. They are disappointed now. So I think that we are living in a situation of flux, that everything is possible.
When you mentioned regime change there, what do you think is the motive? I mean, we keep hearing this. We've seen it in many countries across the Middle East and in Libya and North Africa. The regime change, is it simply that to open the way for Western-backed oil companies, Western-backed corporations, like the sort of McDonaldization of Iran?
I think that it is about, one is, I think, giving a lesson. It's what Noam Chomsky calls sort of this mafia way of thinking, mafia principle. It is, Iran has shown itself to be standing up to the United States, so it is really to make a lesson of it. But I think more importantly, it's about the balance of power geostrategically and control of oil energy resources. So it is very important to have a pliant, pliable regime, a client regime in power, and also about Israel and its hegemonic ambitions to be the sole superpower in the region with incomparable superiority.
Martin, it sort of implies almost that client regimes already exist in other parts of the world, that Iran and Syria are some of the only ones that aren't currently client regimes.
Well, that's absolutely clear. And of course, one of the things they don't like about the Iranians, the Syrians and the Libyans and was that they were trying to get away from the petrodollar, because the whole system works.
Just explain how that works.
Well, the Americans did a deal with the Saudi royal family at the end of World War II, and also again in the 70s, it was revamped, which is that they, because they're the swing state in OPEC, they basically, if you want to buy oil, you've got to have dollars to buy it. Yeah, you've got to have dollars first. Now, that of course gives the US a massive advantage, so they can run a budget deficit which is far higher per head than in Greece, because everybody's got to have dollars in order to buy oil. And so that's really bad if you're a poor African country, for example, with no oil. You've got to export to get dollars to buy oil. And of course, this gives the US enormous power. So they can run budget deficits, for example, which would break any other country. But of course, if countries start trading oil in not in dollars, so Saddam was talking about trading oil in euros, the Iranians are talking about having an oil bourse in euros, and so on. This has got to be stopped, because what that does is it undermines the fiscal policy of the United States to dominate the global financial system. So they can't really be back down here. And of course, the Israelis don't want to back down anyway. So I think I am hopeful about the situation, because I think what's happening here is Putin is doing a bit like Gorbachev did, is I'm going to do the worst thing that can possibly happen to them. I'm going to take away the enemy. So it's actually quite a clever maneuver. And the Russians, in fact, have the capability to fight a world war against the Americans. They would be fools to imagine otherwise. They've put their ship, we were talking about it the other week, this cruiser that the Russians have just infiltrated into the Eastern Mediterranean. It's an aircraft carrier destroyer cruiser of the latest kind, with the latest missiles. A lot of Western kit is very fancy, but it's very vulnerable. And if there came to be a fight around on the coast of Syria or on the coast of Iran, it's not at all clear that the Western navies would win. And of course, that's another thing that keeps us on the side of sanity. Dempsey, who was in charge of the CENTCOM, the US military, I think he may be in charge of the whole lot, he's been saying pretty publicly, don't talk about having a war, it's a silly idea, we'll probably lose.
Well,
is important.
In the event of such a war, no one will win.
No.
Because it will be catastrophic and most likely would involve nuclear weapons, even conventional weapons. I think it would be a devastating global war. But I think what actually made Obama administration to think twice was also seeing Chinese and Russian military fortification in the Mediterranean. They knew that it was serious. And also Iran would be involved. And it will be an unwinnable battle. It will be too costly.
Well, that's what may save us, is because even senior people in the Israeli military and Mossad have been coming out and saying, look, stop all this talk of war, you silly politicians, because in actual fact, it's a catastrophe for everybody, and we're professional soldiers and sailors and so on, and you're all talking rubbish. Shut up, please.
Mehnaz, as an Iranian-born person yourself now here in Bristol, give us a bit of an idea. Where is a good place to go online, since we can't get very much useful from the BBC, any of the big networks, to find good news or information, truthful information if you want, about Iranian opinion and what's actually happening domestically over there?
About Iranian opinion, well, I go to various, I haven't got anything in particular in mind. I read Iranian papers, both official papers and blogs. So I find it very difficult to say which one. I read lots and lots of things, and then you deduce what is happening.
Yeah, we mentioned Press TV earlier on. Obviously, you know, if you can, you won't get them on your satellite, unfortunately. But you can get them on. I think they may actually be a satellite. You can still get them. I'm not absolutely sure about that. Also, what about doing things? You know, if people are. I mean, many people are actually quite excited by the British Parliament's refusal to get involved in this missile strike on Syria. Mm. And it'd be just nice to know, you know, if there are organisations which are actually working to build on that.
Well, there is the Stop the War coalition. I think that it is just so important. A lot of people were despondent that since the Stop the War was founded a decade ago, other wars have taken place. Iraq, Libya, bombings in Pakistan and Somalia and here and there, and we had not achieved anything. And what is happening in Syria, the sanctions imposed on Iran. But in fact, it showed that it doesn't work in a linear way. And something did happen. It did work. I think what is so important is reaching the MPs. I think it is very important to use the available democratic channels when they exist. So people did actually put pressure on their MPs. And it did work. I think that has actually, I was feeling disappointed. I think it sort of enlivened me, it's revitalized me. And I feel that, as Martin says, I mean, what has happened is not the end of it. In Syria, that is not the end of it at all. The threat of war exists. But I think that there is hope that we can actually work, and I think that through the Stop the War, through other anti-war campaigns, but making ourselves heard and contacting our members of parliament and putting pressure on them, challenging the media.
Well, Mehnaz Shehabi, speaking as a Iranian and a Bristolian, thank you ever so much for joining us on Drive Time.
Thank you very much.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Martin, attacking Washington this week, the headquarters of the US Navy, the Naval Yard in Washington, quite spectacular, but it turns out to be an ex-serviceman that carried out the attack, 12 people dead.
Well, yes, I mean, I've been trying to take note of what's been happening. It doesn't seem to have too many political implications, like the shootings at Fort Hood. That seemed to me to be some kind of political theatre. This may be political theatre, but he looks like a standard American nutcase.
But this is quite an important place. He was in a very high security zone, wasn't he? Not like, say, the Woolwich killing, which happened on the street.
No.
And it does start to look as if there may be a political angle to this, because this is one of the places where which manages the US fleet in the Eastern Mediterranean.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, Dempsey, when he was in charge, was basically making noises that a war was a bad idea. And when Admiral Fallon was in charge of CENTCOM, he said, "We're not going to war on my watch." Now, it may well be that those who want war are rather unhappy, because apparently the evidence is that the US military are overwhelmingly against going to war in Syria, and perhaps somebody is deciding to punish them. That's just a speculation.
It does rather traumatise an organisation when they have their own security broken by one of their own people. It's almost like a blue-on-blue attack.
Well, yes, and we see them all the time in Afghanistan, don't we? I think the fact of the matter is that he used the fact that he knew the organisation as a means to get in. Apparently, he just turned up at the security gate he knew to get through, and just got his way in behind somebody who just used the security pass.
He had his own security pass. Well, there. He was working on IT. I mean, he would have probably been all over the internet looking at things that were going on in the world. It may have been some political motive, but I haven't heard any kind of discussion about that at all. The BBC, for example, have put it across as like a Sandy Hook shooting. Oh, this is a crazy man who's just, well, shooting, just shooting people at random.
The Fort Hood shooting is more suspicious because he was working for the US military, the guy that carried that out. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that creating incidents which cause war is part of psychological warfare. It just is. And I'm afraid that the chemical weapons attacking Damascus looks like a false flag psychological warfare operation.
Well, Menaz hasn't disappeared. She's still here and she wants to chip in again, Menaz.
Yes, actually, in relation to what to do, I just remembered that there is the Tory party conference on the 29th of September in Manchester, which has been called by the... there is a demonstration called in front of the Tory party conference by the TUC. It's supported by the People's Assembly. So we want to take the message of cut warfare, not welfare, to the heart of the labour movement, alongside calling to defend the NHS and fighting austerity. There are buses, coaches organised in Brussels, many coaches, so people can go. It's very cheap, between £5 to £10, and it's free for the unwaged, so I encourage everyone to go.
And if you want to have a chat with Menaz, you can get yourself a cheap bus ticket there to the Tory conference and have a chat with her on the way. Martin, finally, the Bloody Sunday Army Colonel Edward Loden was murdered in Kenya. Now, this is a killing of an Army Colonel who was killed in Kenya at the beginning of the month, but our former paratrooper correspondent Richard Cowley has pointed out that this guy was in charge of one para on Bloody Sunday. He's now dead.
Yes, but the reports I've read of this incident, lots of people get killed in carjackings in places like Nairobi and in South Africa. I don't think there is a political motive here. This guy was just unlucky.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Well, down to our final item this week, and it's an extract from an interview with a chap called Stephen Knight. Stephen Knight wrote a book called Jack the Ripper, The Final Solution. These murders took place in London of prostitutes back in 1888, and Stephen Knight spoke to the son of somebody who was involved in those times. And so let's have a listen to him now. He really puts the case that Jack the Ripper wasn't an individual. He was a set of various people who were working for the British royal family.
Sickert told his son, and his son told me, that the women were murdered according to Freemasonic ritual. That much of their ritual is based on murder. They are a secret society. On the whole, they are a society which does good, much good to charity, but they are a secret society of men who meet and perform rituals. Some of their basic rituals are the mime of mythical murders, some taken from the Bible, some taken from Egyptian myth, and these murders are the cutting, or let's take one example. The sign of the entered apprentice, the lowest rank of Freemasonry, is the cutting of the throat from left to right. All the Ripper victims had their throats cut from left to right. At another degree, the mime for initiation is for the victims' heart and vitals to be taken out and thrown over the left shoulder.
Stephen, why this particular mime? I mean, where does this begin, this whole story of... why do they go through the mime of this?
Well, simply to preserve the secrecy of their order. A Mason swears on pain of terribly violent death.
This kind of death?
Yeah, all these various kinds of death, and it varies from level to level, yeah. That he will retain the secrets of his order and never betray another Mason.
Hmm.
When you've reached a certain level in Masonry, you swear never to betray another Mason, whatever he is engaged in, whether it be right or wrong. That covers murder, the lot.
Stephen, back to the murders most foul, these poor women. They were slaughtered in such a way that one would imagine a torrent of blood would have gushed forth on the pavement, yet such very little blood was actually found in except for Marie Kelly's case, around the area of the crime.
Yes, this is one of the enduring mysteries of the Ripper case. No writer has been able to explain it. There was so little blood found at one of the murders, for instance, Annie Chapman's, that the doctor who attended suggested it would have filled one or two wine glasses at most. And yet she had had her head severed from her body almost. There was speculation at the time that the women couldn't have been murdered where they were found, but that they had been murdered elsewhere and then later deposited at these spots. Sickert told his son that the three of the women, at least, were in fact murdered in a moving carriage.
The way in which these murders occurred, surely these women, I mean, it is such a nightmarish tale. They must have screamed, struggled, given some clues as they were being mutilated. The people nearby must have heard something going on.
Not necessarily. According to Sickert, the women were fed black grapes poisoned with laudanum. That's a tincture of opium. And that induced unconsciousness and death before any mutilations were carried out. So there would be no struggle, no screams.
Right.
And it would have enabled all the surgery, the barbaric surgery that took place on them, to be carried out with relative ease and speed.
After which the cab went on its way back to its owner's residence. It was obviously covered in gore and blood. It was washed out, ready for its next grisly assignment.
Well, that's all for this week. Grisly indeed. That was an interview with Stephen Knight, author of Jack the Ripper, The Final Solution. I'm Tony Gosling. Website for this programme at thisweek.org.uk. Please do join us on Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week. And don't let the banksters get you down.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, the outspoken UKIP politician Godfrey Bloom has been stripped of the party whip. The chairman's taken the decision following derogatory comments made against women on the fringes of his party.